The New Statesman podcast is sponsored by Uber. It's coming up to 3 years since Uber and the GMB union signed a landmark recognition agreement, the first of its kind in the gig economy.
Having that recognition with GMB union shows that Uber's serious about drivers' protection.
Ali Haydor drives with Uber and he works as a representative for the GMB union.
The workers contract what the drivers have got is thanks to GMB. They're getting sick pay, national living wage, holiday pension. They're also able to choose the hours they want to work and the days they want to work. Also, they get to choose the jobs they want to do. Now, that is a proper work-life balance. It's full flexibility at the same time as good standard of wage there.
A wide range of issues come from all over the country from our members, and we'll take these issues to the company, discuss with the management, and the team will actually accommodate that. Now, you couldn't get that kind of access on a collective voice if you didn't have the recognition agreement.
Find out more by listening to our special episode titled Reshaping the Gig Economy. Find it in the New Statesman podcast feed now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Stephen.
And I'm Helen.
And welcome to the New Statesman podcast.
Stephen, do we have to talk about Europe?
I'm afraid we do. But we have brought along a friend who will enliven this dark time, which is our Deputy Editor Anoush Chakalian.
Hello.
Right, so a couple of things have happened. One, we've had the first set of televised debates, and two, the polls have moved in a fairly alarming direction for the Remain campaign.
Well, you say the first televised debates, but so far no one's actually debated anyone else, right? So they had Michael Gove was just Michael Gove and a studio audience. And then I watched David Cameron and Nigel Farage do their sort of same format where they have questions from the audience. What I thought about that, okay, mostly, I didn't really tweet anything during David Cameron's half. He went second because it was kind of just dull. Like, he just played a very straight bat. He was just very smooth and pink and unruffled. Nigel Farage, you always have to filter it through the fact that I'm not Nigel Farage's target audience. Mm-hmm. There was an amazing bit where he said, where he had a go at pharmaceutical companies in the EU, and he said, and you know, this guy was a pharmacist who was saying that it was really important for EU-wide drug trials to go ahead. And he was like, well, you know, the thing about pharmaceuticals is that they've been very unfair to alternative medicine makers. And you were like, oh, right, that's your criticism of the big pharma. It's not like any of the things that it bad things that it does, but the fact that it's not kind enough to people who sell sugar pills and placebos. Okay.
Well, that's both Nigel Farage's biggest strength and biggest weakness, I think, because he does just busk it. Like, he's gone completely rogue in the past few days because he's been sort of invisible in this debate so far. And he's not affiliated to the Vote Leave campaign, so they've just got their heads in their hands because they think he's so toxic. But at the same time, he sounds like he's saying new things and having fresh ideas, and he sounds very confident. Whereas, like you said about David Cameron, everything's so bland and on message. So I don't know how Nigel Farage's, the way that he does things will affect what voters think. But I think it might not be as terrible as the Vote Leave camp were worried about. I mean, they told ITV that it was a stitch-up.
I've got to say that in a campaign marred by huge acts of tiny pettiness, Vote Leave blowing its top about Nigel Farage getting and that press release that Dominic Cummings, Vote Leave, authored and put out, and then the fact that they then doxed everybody involved and put their phone numbers on the internet, put all the BBC producers, political producers' phone numbers on the internet, it was so spectacularly man-baby, I cannot even begin to engage with it.
So when I was profiling Vote Leave, there was a lot of stuff about Dominic Cummings from people who've met him over the years, and I couldn't put in just because otherwise it would become a profile of Dominic Cummings. But my favourite, which I think speaks to it, they said he's the kind of person who started behaving in an eccentric and brusque way because he thought that was a way of showing how clever he was in the early 90s. And now it's just become something and and now it's just become his personality. They said it's a bit like those people who like wear a leather jacket and say they're a proper rocker.
I think he's one of the more fascinating, because his character in politics politics, because as you wrote in your piece about the Odd Squad a couple of years ago, he's been involved in, you know, like nasty but successful campaigns like the referendum on elected mayors. No, it was a North Eastern Assembly.
The No to AV campaign followed exactly this playbook we're seeing now, which is, you know, make up a cost, in this case of £350 million, and goes to Brussels every week. It doesn't. And the 75 million Turks who will allegedly be soon granted access to the European Union, they won't. But we know that it can work, and the polls are a bit alarming, although perhaps not as alarming as the sterling markets are suggesting they are.
Okay, well, let's take the polls thing head on, because the trouble is now everybody's in a situation where if you see a poll that you don't like, you just go, but polls, eh? Are the polls completely discredited? Do you think they are herding around a particular solution? Do you think they're not reaching people who are going to vote? Come on, Stephen, tell me. You're the oracle.
So, I mean, there are a couple of important, and this is kind of going to be several half-formed thoughts about polls. One, they got London basically bob on. Pretty much every company called London right to within a percentage point or so. However, and also the historical problem of polls in Britain being wrong is not the polls are wrong, it's that the polls overestimate the Labour Party. Mm. Crucially, they overestimate the type of people who vote for the Labour Party. Young people, people who live in cities, the poor, and people who are more transient for one reason or another. Those are all groups of people who are much more likely to vote Labour, and they're much less likely to be more likely to be over-polled, which means that Labour has tended to underperform its poll rating, whereas actually most of the Tories they've tended to get the Tories about right. The difficulty with the referendum is, one, they don't really have a recent referendum to measure against. Referendum polling is always as hard as it gets. But also because the coalition of voters that you need to get together to get a Remain vote is basically a little bit like the Tories, a little bit like the Labour Party, and a little bit of some odds and sods from the Lib Dems, and then, of course, Scotland, where the political consensus is overwhelmingly for staying in. It's a turnout game.
And Wales is kind of much more against than you might think, right?
Yeah, Wales is... so the interesting thing is, Wales is actually one of the stronger Remain areas. I mean, in terms of what the average share is, you're 5 points more likely to be a Leave voter in Wales than you are elsewhere. Whereas Cornwall, who everyone was worried was going to be a big sort of anti-EU region, actually... all of the information from both sides is that Cornwall is proving trickier terrain for the Leave campaign than they thought, and more hospitable for the Remain campaign. Whereas Wales, there's a lot of hostility towards the EU. There are a lot of finger-pointing as to why that is. Some people, because there are a lot of people who are working class, left behind by globalisation, which is the classic pattern of voting to leave.
It's also not got very many big cities, has it? I mean, there's Cardiff and Swansea, but the north of Wales is much more rural. Anoush, it's okay, there's a theory going round, and the theory is this, that the Labour voters are the problem here, right? That every Conservative voter in the world now, you know, has heard from people that they're interested in politicians that they nominally like, but that Labour voters are not hearing stuff. And Jeremy Corbyn specifically, who has got, as we know, a big personal following, people are really interested in what he says, has not yet had any real impact because, this is the conspiracy theory, he doesn't really care about us staying in. Actually, instinctively, he's Eurosceptic.
I think instinctively, yes, he's Eurosceptic. And we know that in the past he's voted against further integration into the EU, and that he is sceptical about it. And that might be why he feels like he can't really take centre stage in fighting it from from the Labour side. But they don't really have an alternative person doing that. John McDonnell has said a few things about us not wanting to have a Tory Brexit. But really, it's been the Tories' job to make the left-wing case, I think, because you had John Major's big outburst last weekend about the sort of the dishonesty of the Leave camp. And he was talking about how you can't leave the NHS in the hands of the Brexiters who would win the election, because it would be like leaving a hamster in the hands of,
like a snake,
of pythons.
Or something, python, yeah.
And that is a very... That is the perfect case that Labour could be making. If you care about the NHS, if you care about services, then you should vote to stay in the EU. Why has it been up to former Tory prime ministers to make this argument? Why isn't there anyone from Labour being more prominent in that conversation? And I think... Do you remember when Chuka Umunna decided not to run for the Labour leadership? He said that he wanted to focus on the EU campaign. And I know that he has been writing a few things and saying a few things here and there, but he really hasn't been that loud a voice in it.
But I want to know whether or not it's a kind of, does a tree fall without you know, the Telegraph putting it on its front page, did it really happen kind of thing. Mm. Because I, and Stephen, you're probably plugged into the Labour grassroots campaign, things like the phone banking and the canvassing. Because my impression is, yeah, the media is totally focusing on it as a civil war, because civil wars are always more bloody. They're always more kind of interesting. It seemed to be, if you're attacking your own side, then you really mean it. It's not just like, you know, well, the opposition would say that. But are Labour really doing the door-to-door canvassing of their get out the vote operation? Because I know they were holding back during the local elections because they didn't want to kind of muddy that, like in Wales and places like that. Are they now really swinging behind it with their organisational muscle?
Well, the thing is, it very much depends on where you are. In my part of the world, the Labour Party has been canvassing for Stronger In for some time, even before the local elections. But obviously in my fairly middle class, ethnically diverse bit of Hackney, that's not to say it's ethnically diverse and middle class. It's mostly either ethnically diverse or middle class, but those are two fairly happy hunting grounds for Remain campaigners. What's happened in large parts of the country is even where the MP is fairly pro-European, the local party's gone, oh, can we wait? We don't want to lose these local elections. But now the Labour Party is mostly swinging behind it on the ground. I mean, Jeremy is, you know, potentially a bit of a Eurosceptic, but the interesting thing about looking through the 1975 election campaign is the Conservatives, who were almost uniformly pro-European at the top, did not really have a big role in the referendum either. They did lots of things. But exactly as you say, civil wars are sexy. A largely unified party, not so much. And, I mean, so there are a lot. And last time, Harold Wilson's bacon was saved by Conservative and Liberal voters. Cameron will hope that will happen in reverse. But the big difference isn't what the Remain campaign did last time is they fought a very similar campaign to the one we're seeing now. Jobs, security, the economy, all of which are issues which are quite good messages for Conservative voters. They are less good if you are trying to win over more Labour voters, which Cameron needs to do. It's not really clear to me what he has beyond this fear that the Leave campaign will get in, will have a very right-wing prime minister who will eat the NHS, which, I mean, I think is actually a perfectly legitimate fear. And also, ultimately, you know, the poorest in society will bear the brunt of the economic shock than Britain would suffer should we vote to leave. But it does put them in the tricky position of not having a strong Labourite message. But it is mainly than.
Oh, well, I just think, so Peter Wilby, our First Thoughts writer, who is often not afraid to go against consensus, he's predicting a big win for Remain, right? And this is his theory, is that older people, as we know, are more likely to vote. And actually, in the final weeks of the campaign, things like, you know, what is your pension fund safe from this economic shock? You know, those kind of things. The risk averseness will take over. I'm going to ask you, Stephen, first, because this is why I get to ask these things, so I don't have to answer them. You predicted at the start of the year Brexit. Are you still Brexity?
Yes, I think I am, actually. So at the start of the year, I said that then the chances of Brexit were much higher because I thought there'd be a migrant crisis. Of course, we are now having 18 Albanians rescued in the coast, the Navy policing the Atlantic. It's very warm as we're recording it now, which increases the number of people going, I'm having, you know, the weather doesn't look bad. Obviously, I've got ISIS or a failed state in the shape of Libya at my back, or a rubbish economy stricken by climate change in the case of Eritrea. I'll try my hands on this boat. That helps the Leave campaign. I don't think the Remain campaign has a big enough lead in the polls where it still does lead to be certain of that. I think Peter is right that one of the good things about the polls narrowing now is you're starting to see the effects on Sterling. You're starting to see the warnings from the pension funds, which might hit that a bit. But in Scotland, there had been a two-year backdrop of, yeah, if you vote for independence, you know, the sky will fall in, which meant that when people started going, oh, actually, maybe the sky will fall in, people went, oh, well, they've been saying it for a while. 6 months ago, Cameron was saying he might vote to leave the European Union, which means that the fear message is much less powerful and much less effective because it hasn't been going on.
It's
as
not
long.
Something that people have believed for a long time, and you can demonstrably say that they have.
Yeah, and also what you have in this case, unlike the Scottish referendum, is MPs kind of openly contemplating Britain leaving in the EU. We had that story about pro-EU MPs wanting to vote to keep Britain in the single market should Brexit arise. And so they're openly sort of planning to do these
this
things.
This is how we mitigate it, yeah. And you wouldn't really feel the difference.
How to mitigate it, exactly, and use their majority in the Commons to try and soften the blow of Brexit on the economy. And I remember in the Scottish referendum, people weren't even sort of entertaining the thought. I remember they kept denying, Whitehall kept denying that they were sort of wargaming different scenarios and saying that they didn't have a backup plan because it definitely wasn't going to happen. They're not doing that this time. So while I don't really want to make a prediction, I think you can tell from the people in power and the people who are most in touch with the voters and the arguments that they are really worried.
Yeah, I think for me the most worrying thing is the total reluctance, as per Labour at the last election, to come up with a consistent, credible line on immigration, right? Mm. Either you say, I'm willing to actually go out and make the case that 500,000 of the EU nationals in Britain are from Ireland. Are we really saying that we're going to send them home? Mm. Like, you know, all the economic benefits of immigration, there are there, but they've just been distributed unfairly. We're going to redress those things. And so either you make that, or you say, you're right, actually, immigration is a completely terrible problem and we're going to have to find some other way of doing it. But just to kind of constantly going, no, let's not talk about immigration, let's talk about the economy.
Yeah.
I just don't see why someone isn't taking that head on. Well, I can see why, because it would be the least attractive job in politics, right? And also because Labour haven't quite got... Jeremy Corbyn, you could think, would be very well placed just to make a kind of happy-go-lucky, let them all come kind of message. But the party still won't quite let him. And I think that's a real problem.
Yeah, at the moment, you only really hear... you don't hear them because no one reports it, but the Green Party making the positive immigration case, you don't hear it anywhere else.
Yeah.
Well, and business as well.
Yeah, and places like the FT and The Economist saying, hang on a minute, these people are coming here to work and they are largely contributing and boosting the economy. We'd much rather be the kind of place that is attractive, that people want to come and work in, than an economy that is shrinking and doesn't have any, has huge amounts of unemployment.
Mm.
Anyway, that's all we've got time for. Thank you for joining us for this section of the podcast, and we'll see you in a few minutes again, Anoush.
Hi, I'm Caroline.
And I'm Anna.
And we host the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman, Seriously.
If you secretly care more about comics than Jeremy Corbyn, this is the podcast for you.
You can find all our episodes at newstatesman.com/SRSLY.
Right, and now it's time to go down the line to the lobby with George.
Hi, Siren.
Hi, George.
So we had the penultimate PMQs before Parliament breaks up for the EU referendum. And Jeremy Corbyn, who's often appeared reluctant to exploit Tory divisions, famously so after Ian Duncan-Smith's resignation when he failed to mention the former Work and Pension Secretary, took a notably different approach at PMQs and challenged David Cameron to condemn Priti Patel and Michael Gove for their comments on the referendum. And it did seem that he'd been inspired by Angela Eagle's performance 2 weeks ago when she stood in for him and she baited the Tories and put on very much a traditional performance. And it does seem as if Corbyn has belatedly realised that there is political capital to be made from the Tories' epic splits, and he's trying to attempt that.
Right, and how effective was it today?
Cameron parried the blows reasonably well by saying, I don't agree with them, of course we've had collective responsibility suspended. And then he rather exasperatedly remarks, aren't we meant to be on the same side, essentially? I could be mocking Labour divisions. He said, I could have referred to the MP for Birmingham Edgbaston, who's Labour's Gisela Stuart, who was spinning for Nigel Farage yesterday, but let's not go there. And so the suggestion is that Jeremy Corbyn is harming the Remain campaign by picking on these Tory divisions. But actually what Remain strategists say is that they're quite pleased that Corbyn's trying to differentiate himself from Cameron and is delivering a distinctive message on workers' rights and the threat that what Labour call Tory Brexit would pose to them, because that's a way of ensuring that Labour voters, left-leaning voters, turn out on the 23rd of June. And their main concern actually is that the media's coverage of the referendum makes it look like such a Tory-dominated affair, which of course it is in some respects, that Labour voters just feel turned off by the whole thing.
Yeah. In terms of Labour voters not being turned off, Jeremy Corbyn himself is going to be doing a live appearance on Sky 3 days before the vote in the debate. What's the is there anything you can tell us about that?
Yes, so this is going to be his only TV appearance of the campaign, obviously just a few days before the vote. And the opportunity for Remain, as I've said, is that it gives Corbyn a platform to deliver his distinctive message. They will see the risks as him rejecting their economic message in part or entirely. In his recent speech, he mocked George Osborne's forecast of a post-Brexit recession, saying you can't trust him, essentially, look at everything else he's got wrong. And for a campaign that has staked so much on the economy, if Jeremy Corbyn does dismiss that, that is quite a risk. But I think for Corbyn, it's an opportunity, because if we do vote to remain, it will largely be thanks to Labour voters. If we vote to leave, he can say, look, guys, I know I've never been a great lover of the EU, but you know, I did make the speeches, I attended the rallies, and I've been on TV, so it's not as if I sat it out.
Let's assume for a moment that none of this works, then Corbyn's appearances don't help, then the message about the economy from the government and Stronger In don't help, and we do leave the EU. There have been some rumblings this week that pro-Remain MPs will try and keep us in the EEA and other things. Give us some of the background to that.
Yes, so there is one group among which the Remain campaign are going to win a landslide victory, and that's MPs. You have twice as many MPs backing Remain as you do backing Leave. And one scenario is that the country votes to leave, but MPs try to keep Britain in what's called the single market, which Norway and Switzerland, non-EU members, remain in. And that would mean, crucially, continued free movement of people. And Leave have, of course, made it their key campaign pledge to end that. In practice, I think a lot of MPs would be prepared to accept that Leave have mandates for withdrawal from the single market. But if the post-Brexit economic hit is of the severity that some suggest, then they may feel it's necessary to fight to keep Britain in the single market at all costs. One option available to the next Tory leader, who would almost certainly be elected soon after the referendum if David Cameron loses, would be to hold an early general election to seek an unambiguous mandate from the public for single market withdrawal, for ending the free movement of people, for ending EU budget contributions. And there are lots on the Labour side who are actually contemplating that this may be the way that they achieve their aim, their wish of getting rid of Jeremy Corbyn, either in advance of that election or after it, when they fear Labour would suffer a significant defeat.
And on that cliffhanger, it's bye.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
From the lobby.
And now we're joined by our deputy web editor, Anoush Kalyan, to talk about musicals. And there is a news hook, such as it is for this, which is that the Grammys are coming up. I'm going to say Grammys or Emmys. Who knows really?
Tonys.
Yeah, them. Something. An award that ends in Y is coming up. And
Emmys are for drama.
Thank you.
I don't know why I've decided to be really hit up about this. Sorry, as you were. All right, carry on.
But anyway, Hamilton, which is a really interesting example of a smash hit news musical, which is on Broadway at the moment, is hopefully coming to England next year. And it tells the story of one of the founding fathers who kind of came from absolutely nowhere. And one of the things that it does is revolutionary. Obviously, first of all, it's a rap and hip hop musical, but almost cast on non-white. So it just recasts everybody in history as if they were non-white. I'm just going to play you the beginning, because it's a musical that doesn't have an overture, right? It just goes straight into this.
How does a bastard orphan, son of a whore and a Scotsman, dropped in the middle of a forgotten spot in the Caribbean by providence, impoverished and squalor. Grow up to be a hero and a scholar.
And that's probably give you a good idea about whether or not Hamilton is for you, because it's got this brilliant kind of lolloping kind of hip hop beat where things move forward with this kind of really interesting inertia. And so I think what it does musically is really interesting. I've never heard a musical that sounds like this. But it also made me read the Wikipedia page of Alexander Hamilton, and they've given away, I think, 10,000 tickets to school children, and school children from like hard New York schools where they like shoot each other in the, you know, in recess, who probably wouldn't have gone to go and see something that they would see as being kind of lots of people tap dancing, right? So that's my nomination for what a really interesting musical is. Anoush, tell me what you think is a musical that people should go and listen to the soundtrack to or go and watch on film.
I think if people, generally people who don't like musicals or are cynical about musicals should watch Cabaret, I think, because it's not only is the music excellent, it's just not your classic musical. It's really, really dark. And the content in it, I mean, you have sort of Nazis beating people up and thugs outside this sex club and you know, gays and sex. And it's all quite dark. And also it's very political as well. So I think if you think of musicals as sort of a happy clappy jazz hands kind of genre, then go and watch this because it will completely change your mind about what they're like. And I think West Side Story is similar. You have sort of like these outcasts. It's about gang wars on the streets of New York. And it deals with discrimination and politics.
Well, one of the ways I think that West Side Story still feels quite modern is G Officer Krupke. So it's kind of sung in around, and it's basically the story of a young delinquent and all the authority figures he goes to and the different, you know, like different advice that they give him. And it's not kind of quite politically correct, because some of them say like, you know, you've got a social disease, and then some of them sort of say, you know, that they, you know, it's all the excuses basically that he gives to Officer Krupke about why he's no good. And then that's the refrain is like, you know, deep down inside him, he's no good.
Yeah, exactly. And that's also an example of how musicals can deal with quite dark issues. So they talk about him being psychologically disturbed.
Disturbed.
And it is quite politically incorrect now, but I mean, you do still get those sort of people who you still get those arguments about whether or not someone's the way they are because of society, or whether or not it's something in themselves, or is it from their parents or how they were brought up, which is also dealt with in that song.
Can you remind me, because I've seen Cabaret twice, but now I mostly just listen to the soundtrack.
Oh, so do I, yeah.
So it's based on Christopher Isherwood's I'm a Camera, right, which is his memoir of being in the Berlin in the 1930s.
Yeah, that's right.
It's Sally Bowles is a cabaret singer. I know the Nazis come into it, but remind me exactly how the Nazis come into it.
It's set in Berlin when the Nazis are on the rise, and so you have this very glamorous life that the lead characters lead in the Kit Kat Club, which is the sex club, but then it's also interspersed with quite sinister scenes about Nazis coming to power, and you have the Nazi youth song in it, actually, the song Tomorrow Belongs to Me.
Well, when I went to see that with Anna Maxwell Martin as Sally Bowles, they had, you know, and they cast it very deliberately. The guy from Gimme 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 was the MC, and they cast it quite deliberately with all the people in the club being quite dark-haired, and then you had all the blonde Nazis. They did that naked. If you haven't seen people high kick naked, let me tell you, you haven't lived.
I'm always against nudity on stage.
I don't like it either, because it's really distracting, because you end up having to think really hard about not looking at their penises.
Well, I agree. It's a bit like bringing a live animal on stage. It always makes everyone stop concentrating and just seeing like...
And I mean, I think, and even worse is when it's nudity with an animal and if they're undressing on stage, because... The one comforting thing about people undressing on stage is you realise in all of those times you've made a hash of undressing slightly in front of someone, everyone does it, even award-winning actors. But there's always an awkward moment when they're not quite naked, not quite clothed. The grammar of the scene, as it were, has ground to a halt, and we're all just watching a naked person or an animal. Regular listeners know my feelings about animals.
Naked animals are the worst.
Just animals in general.
But I guess in a dance number it's kind of okay, because it's about spectacle anyway. It's not like that's taking you away from this really nuanced scene. The song is inherent and part of it. But I really like Cabaret, and one thing I would suggest that people go and do is go and have a look at some of the different versions, because it's really one of the things I really love about musicals is the way that different casts interpret them differently. Mm. And Jane Horrocks' playing of Sally Bowles, particularly the way that she does the song Cabaret, she does it in this really genuinely anguished way, as if she's having a breakdown, rather than the kind of classical Liza Minnelli, which is much more saucy, I guess.
Yeah, it's saucy and it's ballsy and it's a bit sarcastic, but it's also sort of like, you know, forget about life. You can't change anything. Let's go and have fun. Whereas I can imagine it, the lyrics of the song, again, quite dark.
Yeah,
can
be start by admitting from cradle to grave, you know, there isn't too short to stay. It is It is kind of, it's almost, I'm going to say Beckettian. It is, though. But, you know, there is a line, astride a grave and a difficult birth. That's a Beckett line. So there are kind of echoes of really quite serious things there. Stephen, what is your top musical you'd like to recommend to people?
Well, I mean, I'm going to cheat and do two, because partly I want to say Hamilton.
Okay, but I only told you about Hamilton on Monday, so...
Yes, but I've listened to it on a loop since then. I'm actually midway through rewriting the lyrics to be about the New Statesman, so, you know, look forward to the musical episode.
How does a special correspondent... No, yeah. I can't do it.
But, you know, like, so that coming soon to a podcast near you. Avenue Q, actually. I think not only is it very witty, it actually does have several songs which talk to fairly universal... themes, the lament of the arts graduate, what do you do with a degree in English? That wasn't intended to be an epic level of shade directed at you, but I see how it could be interpreted that way. Everyone's a little bit racist sometimes. It's actually a fairly good bit of social commentary, rising from the low, like the internet is for porn. Yeah, that's a good song.
I haven't seen Avenue Q.
It's actually just quite a good song with some quite good musicals. I mean, my first musical was an old VHS of Joseph and the Technicolor Dreamcoat, which
I would warn people against re-seeing, because after Lee Mead won Any Dream Will Do, I went to see his version of it. And even Lee Mead, who I have to say, on that show, his version of Paint It Black was extraordinary. Couldn't rescue what is essential. It is a school play. It's just a school play.
And also, Lee Mead's no Donny Osmond, is he?
That is the harshest burden of all.
Donny Osmond's great in that. I mean, I can't remember. I haven't watched it since I was about 10. But I, you know how
he's no Jason Donovan. That's who I had in my original cast recording of Jason and Technicolor Dreamcoat.
Did you have a recording of?
I don't remember which Joseph I liked best, but I did love the musical. But I haven't seen it or listened to it since I was in school, and I think we sang it in school, so I probably agree with you.
It's got that terrible Potiphar was counting shekels in the bed below his bedroom. That bit, that is dead.
I just remember the bit with all the colours, which was very exciting for me as a child.
To try and remember, like, red and yellow and orange.
And I think ochre is in there, and I remember learning what ochre was, so it's very educational.
I might find it painful to rewatch it, because when my voice broke, I lost my singing voice. As listeners may learn if they listen to the end of the episode. And so I have actually sung in Joseph and sung well in Joseph. I could not sing in Joseph at all now, which would be fairly upsetting.
I feel like you could I've fairly briskly rescored quite a lot of musicals to fit my limited vocal range. Yeah. I think dare to dream, Stephen.
I'm sure you could sing that Pharaoh rock song. When he's got a really deep voice and it's supposed to be
Elvis,
like Elvis.
One. Uh-huh. Yeah, that one.
That would turn third curls, or something.
Yeah.
Rewrite that to be about the Labour Party. That'd be amazing. I also would like to give a shout out to Book of Mormon, which is currently on, and I think it's by the creators of South Park, as I'm sure most people know. But Grace Dent wrote a piece about it after it came on, saying, like, here is quite a mainstream musical that people are going to see, which is essentially about FGM. Like about efforts to educate people about FGM, and I think it's incredibly do not go and see it with your family, obviously, unless you've got one of those weird modern families where you swear in front of your parents.
Playing a clip from this gonna jeopardize our universal rating.
No, I won't do that. But I will say that what I like about it is it does that thing that satire has often claimed to do, but it doesn't end up doing, which is that it takes the mick out of everybody equally. So it actually the story is basically about Mormons get their mission where they spend 2 years going around trying to convert people. These two ones end up getting sent to Uganda, which they have no idea about, like, where it is. They kind of go, oh, like, Africa, like Lion King. And then get there, discover that all the rest of the Mormons there are, like, insanely cheerful. They're so incredibly upbeat. And there's a song called Turn It Off, which is about the idea that if you're gay or anything like that, you can just turn it off like a light switch. Just pretend it's not happening. Everything is fine. And one of them is a compulsive liar. So he ends up blending all his Bible stories with bits of Star Wars. So you would like this. But they eventually sing the song called I Am Africa, which I'm just going to play a very small part of.
I am Africa. I am Africa. With the strength of the cheetah, my native voice will ring. We are Africa. We are the heartbeat of Africa.
the rhino, meerkat, the noble lion king.
And as you can see, it is quite taking aim at that idea of a kind of white savior complex and, you know, like NGOs who think they can kind of go over and basically sort of sort out all Africa as a kind of country's problems for it. So I would like to make the case that, yeah, musicals can be of interest to people who like politics. And I would like to ask, invite our listeners to tweet us if there are musicals that you think have particularly important political lessons. Perhaps Singing in the Rain has a lot to say about how attractive women are not as good at singing as plainer women, and other important life lessons.
Is that
lessons.
What Singing in the Rain is about?
Yeah, Lena Lamont is the one. But I can't stand him. She's great as a silent film star, and then they try and switch to talkies, and she has to sing, and she can't sing. And then they get Debbie Reynolds, his character, to dub over for her.
Wow, there's this whole, I have like these huge vistas of musical knowledge, which I just know nothing about. So
watch Singing in the Rain. It's a really brilliant film, and it's got some great songs.
I know the
in
last
it.
Time someone told me I was seeing a brilliant film about silent movies, I saw The Artist, and ooh.
Oh really?
Definitely don't watch My Fair Lady again, because that is the most unfeminist musical. It's got two songs in it. One of them's Why Can't a Woman Be More Like a Man? And then there's another one. I can't remember the other one, but there's another whole sex.
The whole premise of it is about kind of creepy, over controlling Professor Henry Higgins trying to like make her not, you know, change her life completely. And then I think, you know, and Eliza Doolittle comes out at the end of that, certainly in Pygmalion the play, as being like, well, now I don't belong anywhere. You've ruined my life. I can't go back to being a flower seller, but I'm not a lady. No one will ever accept me as a lady. Like, it's quite a sad message that comes out of that, that this guy thinks he can sort out everyone else's lives. Like Professor Xavier. Yeah, that harks back to a previous episode. And I pronounced it right this time as well, so our listeners will be happy. Thanks for joining us, Anoush. I know you'll be returning later on in this podcast, so listeners can brace themselves for that. And now welcome to a section called You Asked Us to Sing Stephen's Version of American Pie, that has now been rewritten to be about the Scottish Labour election problems, right?
And also the Labour, but yeah, it's been broadened out. But yes, a while ago I wrote a song on Twitter during election night when I was tired,
it's like 6 a.m.,
and slightly
right?
giddy, yeah. And many of you have asked us to record it. So here it is.
And Anoush Shakalian will be joining us once again to play guitar and lend some backing vocals. And if you are of a sensitive disposition, listeners, I would say that there is a content note on this for bad key changes and or people switching the verse halfway through.
A long, long time ago, I can still remember how Labour used to win the Clyde. They cheered the victory in advance. No other party had a chance, but now there's only Morningside.
But Indy Ref made me shiver with every leaflet I'd deliver. Bad news on the doorstep. I couldn't take one more step.
And I can't remember if Murphy cried when he heard that we'd lost East Kilbride. But something touched me deep inside the day that Dougie sighed. So bye-bye to Kehardie's old guys. They used to win by landslides, now they're stuck on Morningside. Nathan Harris is a blogger doing consulting on the side, singing, what happened to my Glasgow landslide? What happened to my Glasgow landslide?
For 10 years, Cameron's on his throne, a moss grows fat on the headstone, but that's not how it used to be.
Now, did you write the Chilcot report? And do you think Blair should be in court? And can you teach me how to release it real slow?
Well, MacDonald read a book on Marx, Corbyn signed apples in the park, our polling ratings getting dark the day that event sky sighed. So bye-bye to Kehardie's old guys. They used to win by landslides, now they're stuck on Morningside. Harris is a blogger doing consulting on the side, singing, what happened to my Glasgow landslide? What happened to my Glasgow landslide?
We protested war in a summer swelter, but now Iraq needs a fallout shelter. Drones fly high over Pakistan.
The joining fee was just £3. They said sign up and so I did. Boat Corbin was the urge, but then there came the purge.
Chris Harmon tried to cleanse the role. The right refused to yield control. Corbyn topped every poll the day the Blairites cried. So bye-bye to Gihadi's old guys. They used to win by landslides, now they're stuck on Morningside. Now Tom Harris is a blogger doing consulting on the side, singing, what happened to my Glasgow landslide? What happened to my Glasgow landslide?
And the three MPs I admired the most nominated Corbyn, now Labour's toast. They've got no MPs from coast to coast. That is, first past the post.
So bye-bye to Gihadi's old guys. They used to win by landslides, now they're stuck on Morningside. Now Tom Harris is a blogger doing consulting on the side, singing, what happened to my Glasgow landslide? What happened to my Glasgow landslide?
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, presented by me, Helen Lewis, with Stephen Bush. Our producer is India Bork, and our music is Devil with a Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons. You can find us on iTunes or at newstatesman.com/podcast.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. Their meditations range to fit your needs each day, from anxiety and stress, relaxation and focus, to building habits and taking care of your physical well-being. They even have expert-led talks on topics such as tips for overcoming stress and anxiety, handling grief, improving self-esteem, caring for relationships, and more. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.